Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Forum, Nature Biotechnology's podcast, where we talk to leading researchers in the life sciences about the latest advances in their fields. I'm Michael Francisco, a senior editor at the journal. Today on episode 20, we'll be talking about super-resolution and expansion microscopy, which enables complex biological systems to be imaged with nanoscale precision. Our host is Barbara Shafei, chief editor of Nature Biotechnology, and her guests are Ed Boyden, a professor in the departments of Brain and Cognitive Sciences, Media Arts and Sciences, and Biological Engineering at MIT, and Johann Donzel, assistant professor at the Institute of Science and Technology, Austria. Barbara, expansion microscopy is a really exciting technology and quite interdisciplinary, with biology, physics, and engineering all involved. Can you tell us a little more?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. So expansion microscopy is a technique where the cells are embedded in a polymer gel, which is then swelled up to expand the sample, enabling us to see really small nanoscale cellular structures. So traditional light microscopy techniques have really been plagued by limitations imposed by laws of physics, which prevent these microscopes from resolving features below a certain size, which is known as the diffraction limit. So super-resolution approaches are overcoming this physical limitation, and we can now see small cellular structures at the nanometer level, and this discovery actually won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2014.
Great. Can you tell us a little more about your guests, Ed and Johann?
Yeah, Ed and Johann both work on developing super-resolution and expansion microscopy methods, and both look at imaging neurons and cells in the brain. Ed specifically works to map and image the brain in order to eventually be able to repair neural circuits and disease. And Johann is also working on the brain and tissue imaging, as well as developing computational methods to analyze these data.
Great. Let's get into it. Here's episode 20 of Nature Biotechnology Forum.
Hello, welcome back to the Forum podcast. Today we're going to be talking about super-resolution microscopy, and I have with me Drs. Ed Boyden from MIT and Johann Donzel from the Institute of Science and Technology, Austria. As we all know, many core components in our cells, such as DNA, RNA, proteins, and lipids, are only a few nanometers in size, which is substantially smaller than what can be seen with traditional light microscopy. So I guess this leads me to my first question for you both, which is, could you describe, briefly, what super-resolution microscopy is compared to what we traditionally think about when we discuss microscopy images? Ed, do you want to go first?
I guess I can go first, sure. Light has a finite size or wavelength, and seeing things much smaller than the wavelength of light is very difficult due to the laws of physics. But in the past several decades, there have been several methods proposed for breaking that diffraction limit of light microscopy using different physical and chemical tricks. You can take many photons from a single fluorophore and then find the centroid of where the photons came from as a way of pinpointing the location of a fluorophore. You can use clever tricks with lasers to excite and de-excite fluorophores in order to hone in on just a subset of them. And then recently, our group has been, and Johann and others have been pioneering technologies in this space as well, a strategy of taking biological specimens and through a chemical process making them physically larger, which we call expansion microscopy. So there are different physical and chemical tricks that you can bring to bear to overcome this previously thought to be fundamental diffraction limit of light microscopy.
Johann, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think this was a very good description. So what people realized, and I think this is a great achievement, is that we don't have to live with what microscopes give us per se, but really we can, rather than just optimizing the optics, there is room to think out of the box and come up with concepts that would allow us to distinguish fluorophores, which wouldn't normally be distinguishable. And well, the first concept that was introduced in that regard was STET microscopy, by turning off those fluorophores that should be silent at any given time. And then, you know, based on this, a plethora of methods came up that nowadays constitute an amazing toolbox to look at biological specimens with much higher precision and definition than what the standard laws of physics would allow us to do.
Yeah, thanks. That's really great. So, you know, we were talking, you know, standard light microscopy is about roughly 200 nanometers, right, is what we can image there. And, you know, now we're talking about imaging down to the angstrom level, which is 0.1 nanometers, which is, you know, approximately the diameter of an atom, which is just crazy to me. So what were the main, I guess, technological advances that enabled us to get to this level of imaging? You mentioned a couple of specific methods that have been developed.
Yeah, well, as I said before, to take fluorophores not as something that simply shines, but as something that can be actively controlled, or whose molecular properties, whose molecular states can be exploited, that was a key ingredient. And with this, it's now possible to either deterministically write on-off contrast into the sample with a light pattern, or to keep fluorophores within a diffraction-limited spot silent, except for one that we can then localize with very high definition.
Yeah, the expansion methods that we've been playing with, you know, we use a hydrogel to pull apart fluorophores, or to pull apart biomolecules that can be labeled with fluorophores. So we can take a preserved biological specimen, form a swallowable hydrogel throughout it, anchor key biomolecules or labels to the hydrogel, soften up the specimen, and then adding water expands the gel and pulls apart those labels or fluorophores. So that's another riffing off of what Johan was outlining, a strategy for separating chemicals so that an ordinary microscope, in this case, can image them. And the chemicals could be the fluorescent labels attached to the biomolecules, or in the case of fluorescent proteins, they can be genetically encoded biomolecules themselves.
Yeah, that's very cool. So you're able to see these structures at many different levels. So I'm guessing, you know, all of these different methods have specific biological applications that, you know, some methods are probably better suited for certain questions and others might be suited for other questions. Could you talk a little bit about that, and how do you determine which microscopy method would be the best?
So I would maybe argue that it's not just about a particular method, but if there is a certain imaging task, one would really want to think through the type of information that one would like to extract from a particular measurement, and then take all the aspects into account. And that includes how to label specific molecules, what resolution we ultimately want to target, whether we want to image in a living or in a fixed specimen. And the spatial scales, not just down to the nanometer scale, but also across scales that we eventually want to target. And that's the beauty of the stage that we are now in the field, that there is a lot to offer to researchers in all these dimensions.
Yeah, different technologies will have different sort of fundamental limits and also different practical limits. Some will work well with living samples, some will not work at all with living samples. Each one also has characteristic resolutions, numbers of colors, and applicability to 3D specimens. Some are limited to fairly thin samples. Others can scale to large 3D samples. So thanks to the clear physical and chemical principles of these tools, there's a way of thinking about the scientific question that needs to be answered that then can lend itself to a choice of tool.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, sorry, yeah.
And maybe one thing that we should keep in mind is that we are typically not visualizing the biological structures themselves, but what we are visualizing is the fluorophores. And this is a very important aspect, in the sense that we need to have good ways of targeting these fluorophores to our structures, and we need to make sure that they are not far displaced from our structure of interest. So taking these things into account will not only guide the choice of super resolution method, but really guide the overall process.
That makes sense. So you both have mentioned here doing this in living cells. I know that a lot of this work has previously done in vitro conditions on slides, but what are the differences that we're talking about when we're trying to do an experiment and visualize components of a living cell?
Well, I would argue that first and foremost, we need to be able to extract the information that we want in a manner that is compatible with the living tissue. And quite generically, there will be an interlinked conundrum of limitations, meaning there is signal-to-noise ratio that one would like to achieve in a particular measurement. There is a certain target resolution that one would like to achieve to extract a certain type of information. But at the same time, the cells or the tissue will only want to be exposed to a certain amount of light. And to break these intertwined limitations is a matter of very intense ongoing research.
In our group, we focused on imaging of fixed tissue, so non-living things, through the extension process that I mentioned. So I'm less familiar with the live sample methodologies. But there are some interesting tricks you can play with fixed tissue imaging. So for example, many multiplexing techniques, where you bring in probes, image a specimen, and then remove them over many cycles, have become very popular, for example, in the spatial transcriptomic field, or methods for amplifying the brightness of a single molecule by enzymatically or otherwise attaching large numbers of fluorophores to a target. Some of these techniques are really specialized for preserved tissue or cell preparation. And so if one can do a fixed tissue or cell experiment, there are a number of specialized techniques that the community has been developing that are interesting in their multiplexing amplification spaces.
I think Ed touches on a very interesting topic here that one may think about, which types of measurements are best done in the living specimen, which are best done in a fixed specimen. And if you think about it, in fixed specimens, you have much broader options in terms of choice of super resolution imaging, including, for example, expansion microscopy. And there's a much wider choice in the labeling options. On the other hand, clearly, the dynamic aspect is uniquely unlocked with live imaging. And for example, if I talk about our own research here, we recently took an approach across various disciplines, taking in elements from neuroscience and sample preparation and labeling, but then also optical modifications to STET microscopy and improvements to the imaging process via deep learning strategies. And then amalgamating these developments from different fields really help address some of these big challenges.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Ed, you know, when talking about this expansion microscopy technique that you're working on, what questions are you asking to look at? Are you looking at one cell and blowing it up to visualize the smaller structures, or what questions are you specifically looking to see?
Yeah, in our group, our day job is sort of focused on the brain. So our initial experiments were focused on cultured cells and mouse brain tissues. But one of the interesting things about expansion is that individual groups can tune it for their own purposes. So a group at Stanford, Bo Wang's group, tuned it to expand bacteria and look at the microbiome, for example. You know, one of my alumni, Jabram Chang, now at KAIST in Korea, has published a bioarchive preprint on expanding the entire mouse body, an embryonic mouse body, including bone and cartilage. So people can tune each of the steps, the polarization, anchoring, softening, and expansion steps to be customized easily for different purposes.
If I may amend to this, so one of the beauties of, many of these imaging technologies, but also expansion microscopy in particular, is that improvements in one aspect of the workflow often will be very modular and will directly translate to the overall outcome. So we are constantly on the lookout where we get interesting new input also that we could incorporate and put this together into something that finally allows us to unlock some new type of information, which is what we ultimately want.
So are you talking about new information such as different cellular structures or how structures are interacting within a cell? Or can you give a couple of examples of I guess, things you've found interesting?
Mm-hmm. Well, in many imaging approaches, or I think what the field is in general doing is that we realize that cells are not just made of proteins. I mean, they're made of many, many different constituents. There have been spectacular advances in imaging proteins, but then also putting them into their structural context, into the cellular context, and taking other biomolecules, as Ed mentioned in the beginning, to visualize the transcriptome, to visualize how the DNA in the nucleus is organized, to visualize, for example, lipid molecules. And all these things are part of the cell, and we are so used to just seeing a very selective subset of molecular entities, which may just be one or two proteins, but that's far from the general setup of such a cell. I mean, a cell is made out of well, maybe it's beyond 10,000 proteins being expressed in a single cell, and then think of all the other molecular entities. So I think we're, as a field, working our way towards appreciating more how complex cells are, how complex they are in terms of their spatial organization and the molecular organization, and then how complex tissues are.
Yeah, riffing on that, I think one of the great themes of biology is if you know structure well enough, you can make some pretty deep inferences about function, whether it was the double helix or the genetic code or the structure of the earliest proteins to be crystallized. Seeing something can lead to big insights, hypotheses, and insights into how it works. And at the levels of cells, tissues, and organs, and even entire organisms, our structural appreciation down to fundamental building blocks, anyway, has been extremely difficult. But knowing how two molecules talk to each other by interacting, knowing how the components of a complex are organized in three dimensions to form molecular machines like ribosomes or synapses, or how an immune cell confronts an invader. I think there's a lot of different areas where the interface is nanoscale, and seeing how it works can give enormous insights into what's going on in a healthy or disease state.
And one development that I find particularly exciting in the field is that we're moving exactly from mainly working with generic cultured cells on a cover slip to the real world setting of, as Ed said before, how the brain is organized, how various organs are organized in different species. And this very nicely complements and extends the work that is, more generic molecular interactions, which I also want to emphasize has seen tremendous progress in the very recent past. I mean, you mentioned being able to image down to angstrom levels, maybe seeing how proteins walk along their tracks and visualizing how two molecular entities interact with each other on the nanometer scale. I mean, this is fantastic, and I think that the field is doing both, moving to the finer and finer details, but then also zooming out, giving the bigger context and imaging across scales.
Yeah, so what, now that we're talking a bit about where this is going in the future, where would you both like to see this technology be applied in the future?
Well, I'm very excited about the build off of a theme we talked about earlier, this whole idea of seeing the structure of life. How are molecules organized to create cells, which in turn create tissues and organs? When you see something, you can start to understand the building blocks and how they work together, right? So sequencing DNA, which led to the field of genomics, and now, insights into gene regulation, gene expression, all sorts of things have emerged and have yielded enormous insights into DNA and DNA functionality and DNA-related diseases as well. But what about proteins? and nucleic acids other than DNA and sugars and carbohydrates, and the list goes on and on. You know, many of these also play very critical roles in healthy states and functions, as well as in disease states and progression. And so to understand how those building blocks of life are organized, how they talk to each other, meaning how they bind, change each other's conformation, result in fusions or cleavages of molecules, you know, all the ways that chemicals interact, really requires us to see those, I would argue, in the intact state as much as possible, in a disease state, maybe even ideally in a human cell or tissue, so we can understand how that configuration of biomolecules works together, and also how that goes into a drain state in a disease or pathological state. But I think if we really sort of visualize what it might look like, imagine you could see how these molecules are interacting in a certain state, and you see a drastically different configuration of the disease state. Maybe looking for a molecule that has a wildly different configuration could yield an interesting therapeutic target that might not be imaginable even if you didn't see how they're all organized, right? You know, imagine a bunch of known genes involved with, let's say, rare variants of a condition, and there might be another gene whose product you might not see implicated in those genetic variants, but it's a hub that talks to all the other ones, right? Maybe there are ways of mapping out signaling through very detailed visualization down to molecular scale.
So I think Ed said something very important when he was naturally alluding to genetic variants and how things may be altered in certain conditions. And what I think will happen, what I'm very excited about, is that we will be able to give tools to biologists researchers in general to integrate these advanced imaging tools into regular biological workflows that are multimodal in their nature. And with this and working across the various fields, it will eventually be possible to, well, quite naturally find out what the mechanistic correlates of, for example, a particular genotype are. And if you imagine that we go from a particular genotype to a gross phenotype in a certain mutation, it could be, for example, a developmental brain disease and associated with microcephaly or something like. And as we did in collaboration with a neuroscience group here at IST, with the group of Guy Novarino, we could then link the genotype to a migration phenotype, to microcephaly, which was mirrored in a behavioral phenotype. But then also it turned out that these cells have a structural correlate in terms of their actin cytoskeleton organization, which means that the cells, neuronal progenitor cells, are just not as well able to migrate. And you know, beyond the imaging developments per se, I think it will be very exciting to incorporate all these developments into these real-world settings where they lead to tangible biological, biomedical output.
So are all of these, you know, applications, are these technically possible now, or do we have technical challenges that we need to address before we can start to look at this?
Well, I think there are definitely challenges for sure. You know, building from the analogy to DNA, right? You have to be able to label and see something in a light microscopy context. So in light microscopy, we're mostly looking at some kind of label attached to a biomolecule. We're rarely looking at the raw biological material all by itself. And so labeling different kinds of biomolecules, like sugars, like carbohydrates, like lipids and proteins, is challenging. I mean, there are labels that exist. For example, for proteins, there are antibodies. But it's still very challenging. You know, antibodies, a company might cancel the part number, and you know, there's always, I think this is well reported by many previously, you know, antibodies you know, are sometimes difficult to validate or to understand how they perform in different contexts, like different fixation contexts or different species and so forth. So I think the labeling is one of the major challenges in the time to come.
Well, but there is all kinds of practical challenges, even if a particular protein, for example, is labeled perfectly and you can in principle image it. But then if you want to incorporate it into a workflow, you want to be able to image this at with high reliability, at high throughput, You want to be able to make sense of the data that you generate. I mean, as Ed was saying before, we're on the verge of being able to visualize a multitude of molecules at the same time in the tissue. It could be proteins, but it could be RNA molecules, and we are on the verge of being able to decode, you know, even the most complex cellular structures. But then for a human, this becomes extremely challenging to interpret. And what I see coming is a parallel evolution in the different fields that finally go into it. And that will be labeling, as I just said, the imaging process itself, but then also very prominently the data analysis. And I think this is now just being appreciated, and I'm extremely grateful to our computer science colleagues who are really enabling the field here as well.
Yeah, so Johan, I want to get back to one point that you mentioned previously, which is about how to move this field forward. We have these techniques and we need other biologists to expand and get the bigger picture and work with other biologists to bring this technique kind of to the masses, right? To really figure out what's going on within a cell. So how do we make these microscopy methods more accessible to researchers who are maybe not familiar with how to work these microscopes?
Well, it's not just about working the microscopes, but it's getting people aware of all the aspects that are relevant to it, getting to the essentials of the process. So I would argue that Ed has doing an exemplary job here in making things available to the community, and he's certainly a very good role model for all of us here. And well, what can we do? I mean, we can tell people in our papers how things are done in the most, you know, educated manner, and trying to give them as much first-hand insight as we can. There will be, courses, practical tutorials, and all these things finally make people more aware of it. Many of the considerations are common to all super resolution technologies, like labeling or the displacement between, like labeling density. How do I sample a biological structure with fluorophores? Or linkage error, how far are my fluorophores displaced from the actual target that I want to visualize? But then each method has its specifics that people also need to take a bit of time to become aware of them. The dedicated groups, it's their job to help educate adopters.
Yeah, education is such an important theme. For the expansion methods that we're working on, we've tried very hard to put forth photographic tutorials on how to perform it. We've helped run short courses at different institutes around the world. At least pre-COVID, we did that quite a bit. Afterwards, now, thankfully, many institutions are starting their own user group or message boards or short courses to learn the expansion method. One thing that we are excited about on the expansion side is to maintain forms of it that can be used by people with fairly modest microscopy hardware. There's also, I think, a new branch beginning where people are expanding objects and then using very advanced microscopes to get extraordinarily high resolution images as well. But this goal of democratizing technology, you know, and a lot of the fastest spreading techniques are very easy to use, right? Look at fluorescent proteins or CRISPR. They're easy to use by individual biologists. As that's something we're trying to see if we can reserve in this goal of realizing, you know, magnification through chemical means.
But for those people who are privileged to work at institutions that run central core facilities, to have these well equipped with state-of-the-art microscopes is certainly enabling for many groups. And I think it's an important concept that research institutions should pay attention to centralized resources, which means that many people will be able to use these microscopes. They will be maintained at a high level, and well, usage numbers are then high enough to also justify the purchases. And one thing that has probably changed in the past 10 years or so, super resolution microscopes have also become much more widely available, and this and other microscope modalities for sure as well. This is definitely helpful to help people lower the threshold to apply these technologies.
I would imagine this is really significant when we start talking about bringing this type of microscopy into like a clinical setting. You know, Ed, you were talking about using these images to look at, you know, abnormal cellular structures, or as Johan, you were saying, genetic variants. And if we're going to start doing this kind of with a clinical based application moving forward, you know, you have to have it available to people who will take that forward as well. Do you see any other clinical, you know, in the future, clinical applications, diagnostics, perhaps, or anything else you can think of?
Well, sometimes the step for these methods to be applicable to human tissue is actually not so big. Once you try them, you may realize, oh, it's actually possible to work with formalin fixed and paraffin embedded tissue. I mean, clearly, one has to keep in mind that these samples were typically collected just for routine medical diagnostics at a different resolution level. So the structural preservation of the samples is something that one needs to be aware of. But having said this, it's quite astonishing of what is still preserved even with these standard sample preservation techniques. And I think it's totally worth to take or to explore new methods and see how applicable they are to these types of specimens, like pathology specimens, and at the same time maybe take inspiration from those instances in medical diagnostics where high resolution is actually required, and then take advantage of these properties that light microscopy has, meaning it's great at visualizing specific molecules, and it's getting better and better at visualizing tissue architecture, and then it's easy to employ, and with super resolution technologies, the detail that can be unraveled is ever increasing.
Yeah, and for a technique to attain full medical use, of course, there are many concerns beyond the science. Who's going to pay for it? Will insurance or governments and so forth cover it? Regulatory aspects, of course. And then, of course, the education and training of clinicians, which takes place over extended timescales, and often will be reflected in the enduring hardware infrastructure of a hospital or other facility. And so a couple years back, we published a paper in Nature Biotech, actually, where we were brought together with, it was sort of a self-assembly, I guess, process with many pathologists over at Harvard Medical School to see if the expansion method could be used to help do nano imaging for cases like nephrotic kidney disease or the early stages of a cancer. And so we did a study that we published together, which showed that in situations like nephrotic kidney disease, where these nanoscale podocytes are typically seen through electromicroscopy, indeed we could see it on a light microscope, an ordinary light microscope after expansion, or we could look at early in breast cancer at a stage which is often ambiguous for doctors to discriminate, and we could by expansion assist in the analysis of such tissues. But of course, that's not the first step of a very long path, which arguably has not yet been fully taken yet. And so it's very, I think, important to feel the bidirectional flow of information, the pool and constraints of the clinical world, but also the excitement and the push of the cutting edge tools. But ultimately, what makes it into the medical world will be due to the balance between those two forces.
But there is a very interesting intersection area, not just in terms of medical diagnostics that you were mainly alluding to, but also in terms of pathophysiology. And I think this is where I think these technologies can make a huge difference by being able to phenotype specimens as a function of disease state, as a function of inflammatory state, and help make sense of this. And then in a more roundabout way, you could argue that this would indirectly benefit patients in the medium term.
Yeah, and is this something that, AI is going to help with at any point? Do you see some potential for AI methods? I guess, Johan, you were talking about the computational downstream analysis of these images, but
Oh, absolutely. So it has been one of the most joyful experiences for us to with visual computing colleagues to venture into that arena. Well, new concepts are just emerging, how to amalgamate developments in deep learning, in visual computing, with the way microscopy images are generated on one side, but then also how they interpret it. For example, if you think of image restoration, which can be deep learning based and which allows you to channel in prior information from a multitude of separate measurements, such that the artificial intelligence system already kind of knows what the sample should look like, and you use the actual measurement to provide the missing information on specifically that sample. And then at this information together allows you to reconstruct the sample in much more detail than you could with just the physical measurement alone. So we recently employed this to reduce light exposure in live STED imaging. But then also on the analysis side, deep networks are amazingly good at recognizing structures, at making sense of things that are too complex for humans to do or too tedious. For example, hand painting some of our cellular life imaging 3D nanoscale structures that I alluded to before took a trained segmenta for a tissue cube of 500 microns cubed, which is really not big. It took that person 500 hours. So to be able to delegate this to a computing cluster is an enormous benefit.
I think that's a really great place to close and wrap up here. I want to thank you, Johan and Ed, for both sharing your perspectives on this topic. It's been a really fascinating conversation. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That was episode 20 of Nature Biotechnology Forum. Many thanks to our guests, Ed Boyden and Johan Donzel. You can listen to all episodes of this and our other podcasts by searching Nature Biotechnology wherever you find and listen to podcasts. If you have any thoughts or comments on our podcast, please tweet us at Nature Biotech. That's all for now. Until next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things.
Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.